Good morning. Well, that's pretty loud. Okay, I'll back up. My name is Chung Nguyen. I'm chair of the President's Advisory Commission on Asian American Pacific Islanders. I would like to welcome you to this session on AAPIs and aging. Before we get started, I want to thank the AAPI caucus and Elena Ong in particular for putting this session together. So please give her and the caucus a big round of applause. Just a couple of preliminary comments. As a primary care physician who worked in San Francisco, I see older Asian patients deal with a lot of issues, poverty in particular, social isolation, limited functionality, and memory loss. They and their families have trouble finding culturally appropriate social services, and it's also, as a provider, it's a great challenge to find the scientific information and the resources to help them. Last week, the Annals of Internal Medicine published a paper on the cost of care in the last 5 years of life, and dementia, one of the most common condition in aging, costs about twice as much as cancer. So that's the first big important thing about the impact of the kind of work we're talking about. But also, a lot of that additional cost is actually not borne by the healthcare system. It's actually borne by families and people around the older people. And as we know, Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders in general, have a strong family culture. So our young people are also bearing the burden of this. On a personal note, tomorrow, my family is actually moving my mother into a memory care unit after 10 years of trying to take care of her at home. So I understand actually the cost of taking care of both financially, emotionally, and otherwise of taking care of older patients who don't speak English very well. The genesis of this meeting began in May when the commission met in DC for AAPI Heritage Month. The commissioners working on these issues felt that there was so much that needed to be done about aging in this population. So besides being very informative, I know that the presenters that we helped put together here today will inspire you all to tackle this highly significant issue that touches all of us, either directly or indirectly. So to get the meeting started, I will introduce our moderator, Mr. Richard Louie. Mr. Louie is a journalist and news anchor for MSNBC and NBC News. And before that, at CNN Worldwide, he became the first Asian American male to anchor a daily national cable news show in the United States. His reporting has been focused on politics, and he has covered every national election since 2004, and I'm assuming this next one too, yeah, maybe. Mr. Louie contributes to the columnists for multiple news outlets, including USA Today, Politico, Huffington Post, and others. I think unique about Richard's work is that he's done a lot of community work and work in terms of policy as well. He's part of the White House Leaders Forum, a policy fellow at UC Riverside, a United Nations spokesperson, a U.S. State Department traveling speaker, an ambassador for various non-government organizations. He's also received civil rights awards from organizations such as the National Education Association, Asian Americans Advancing Justice, the Asian American Journalists Association, and OCA. So please welcome Richard Louie.
Thank you so much, Dr. Nguyen. I really appreciate it. It's always great to see you. And it's not that early, but I got to tell you, what's kind of frightening for me and making me feel very inadequate is being around so many doctors. All of you are used to that, seeing scientists and leaders in this space. So on our esteemed panel, which you're going to hear from very shortly, I want to get a sense of who all of you are first, though, and a very good morning to you. How many here are students? Hot dog. All right. Policy advocates. Fantastic. Scientists? Local providers? Great. All right, gives a good sense of who we're talking to this morning. And as Dr. Nguyen was talking about, I myself also am becoming more aware and educated personally on the need for understanding in this space. And amongst all of these great thinkers here in the space, my own father, for instance, whose Alzheimer's has recently picked up, I spending more time in the West as opposed to New York City, and we looking at some of the solutions and how our community, specifically in San Francisco, supports individuals like my father in the great hometown of that Dr. Nguyen also is a big name in. So it is something certainly that I think many of us have personal stories to share about that. And as we do talk about this topic, at least on MSNBC and NBC News, I think it's something that we can do more about, and especially when we look at the different subgroups, and the subgroup we're looking at today, of course, is AAPIs. And I think that the dominant thought about this community is that it's perhaps a little bit more healthy, or a little bit more tankish is the way I like to call it. If you walk through the Chinatowns or the Asia towns across the country, I always think of the little old ladies and the little old men, you know, moving along. And I think that reputation of them being more healthy than others is something that is widely thought. But as we know through the statistics, which we'll get into, that is not necessarily always the case. So we have some very esteemed speakers to share their thoughts with you today. Not only Dr. Nguyen, we also have four others that will be sharing the microphone with us today to share some of their thoughts and ideas on how to understand the community and to address all of your questions as well at the end. And I think that'll be the most invigorating. And if throughout any part of this program, if you want to be a little bit more, well, less Asian and get close to us, we don't mind that. We've got all these great empty seats in front. In fact, that's where we put all the reports, so you can come on up and grab a seat at any time if you feel that magnetic energy that I feel from the five people up here. Let me start by introducing Dr. Jeanette Takamura. She has been the Dean and Professor at the Columbia University School of Social Work since 2001. She was Assistant Secretary for Aging in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services from 1997 to 2001. Dr. Takamura led the development of the Modernized Older Americans Act and the National Family Caregiver Support Program enacted in 2000. She also led more than 40 executive branch agencies in identifying national aging policy, as well as being Dean and Professor at the Columbia University School of Social Work since 2001. She was Assistant Secretary for Aging in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services from 97 to 01 as well. Dr. Takamura led the development of the Modernized Older American Act and as well as the National Family Caregiver Support Program enacted in, and I'm reading it twice over because I like it that much. She's just quite amazing. So please do welcome Dr. Jeanette Takamura. Maybe I need more coffee, Dr. Takamura.
I was a little worried there for a minute.
So, empathy for my father.
I know. So, you know, the good news, Richard, is this, that there are a lot of people on the podium or the panel up front who have PhD degrees or MD degrees or whatever, but I can assure you that some of us can care, but we cannot cure, because our degrees are not necessarily medically oriented. That said, I want to give special thanks to Elena Wong. Is she still in the room? She might have left.
She's hovering outside.
Okay, she's outside. So she did a remarkable job, along with Lon, in putting together this very special event for you today. We're all delighted to be here. We also want to thank all of the panelists for making time to, I think, address a very important issue and a set of concerns. So let me say that, you know, there are PowerPoints that I have available, but I'm not going to use them because 10 minutes goes like that. And I don't want to get stuck on PowerPoint number 3 and then lose, you know, the next 7 or whatever. So I'm going to talk a little bit about this and say as well that the White House Conference on Aging report has not yet been released. And I called Nora Super to find out actually whether I could get my hands on some of the data, et cetera, and she said it's really not out there yet. So consider this a preliminary analysis, and consider this kind of food for thought for the future. I think the future is really important. I have a father who's 100 years old, and he announced about 2 weeks ago that he plans to live to 110. So that means we've got a lot of work to do here. I just want to say this about the White House Conference on Aging. I think it's important to think about it. It's probably the finest living example of participatory democracy. Think about that. We have very few other such federal, national examples in which people from all across the country would be able to input and perhaps even shape policy and program development. That was at least the vision when it first began. And in 1956, some forward-thinking person in the Eisenhower administration said, oh my God, look at the demographic trends coming up. We have to do something about aging. And so the conceptualization of the importance of working on aging issues began back then. I will tell you that 60 years ago. And one thing that I will say is that as much as we've made much progress, it has been slow. I think the National Institute on Aging should have a budget that's manyfold as time now. I think there are lots of things that really should be reconfigured in order to address current realities as opposed to realities that have been with us for the last 60 to 100 years. So that's just, you know, pitch right from the start. But if it is then an example of living participatory democracy, then the question becomes, will it remain relevant going into the future? What I should tell you is if you look at the Older Americans Act, which really was the blueprint for aging services and programs and at least the foundation for the beginning of policy development, you will see that in its title, Title I, there's really no mention of diversity. And so everything that happened pretty much emerged around the 1971 White House Conference on Aging. And following that, following the 1971 White House Conference, what you saw was more and more differentiation, more and more specialization. So it wasn't just mental health, it was specifically, you know, depression, suicide, Alzheimer's, and it wasn't just services, but it was services in the home and the community, and also in institutional care. And I could go even farther. The tree has many, many, many roots, and it has grown over time. As a result of that kind of differentiation, it becomes very difficult to actually try to bring people together around one issue, because people are, frankly, spread all over the spectrum. So if we look to all the White House conferences subsequently, what we saw is a shift from the notion of being aged to aging, which is a process that begins from the point of birth. But in addition to that, that differentiation continued. And by 2005, what we saw was, I would say, the beginning of a trend that I wish we could end, but I have a feeling it's here to stay. And that is that we had seen a greater influence of ideology on the formulation of policy. And in 2005, the White House conference was clearly an ideologically driven conference. President Bush decided he was not going to attend. Some of you who were there will remember that. And much of the conference was actually built around the private sector. So the people who had been engaged in aging services and program and policy development for decades were not able to participate as easily as in prior years. What happened in 2015, just this year, is that we saw again a shift, and this time it was a shift to the use of technology. Now remember the notion of participatory democracy, and we have to ask ourselves, what does that mean going into the future? In the past, there would be elections of delegates at the statewide level, and people would scramble and lobby, and it was really, you know, nudging and fist-fighting to get to be a delegate. One year, I think it was 2005, I was appointed delegate from two different states for three different reasons. And I thought, oh my God, you know, I could sell this pass, right? So if we look into the future, and if we say maybe the White House conference isn't going to be quite the same ever again, maybe it's going to take more of a, you know, a dedicated network on television in which issues are presented and people get to press and vote, you know, whatever. Maybe it's going to be totally different. I think it would be really flawed for us to think that we will see the future be exactly like the past. I mean, think about flash mobs. Think about, you know, what happened since the first one in Macy's department store occurred in New York to now. This happens all around the world. And if you think about Twitter and all the other electronic means of communication, we are no longer necessarily writing a letter. We're no longer necessarily just an email. So I think that the future, if there are any White House conferences on aging, will certainly be very different from the past. The reason I say if is because the fate of the White House Conference on Aging has always been dependent upon a number of things: presidential priorities, congressional champions, and if it were not for Eisenhower in 56, we probably would not have the Federal Council on Aging, it would not have led up to the Older Americans Act. If we didn't have people like Senator Claude Pepper of Florida, who's known as Mr. Social Security, and Congressman Edward Roybal of California, I don't think aging issues would have really made their mark in both houses of Congress. Today, I would ask you to think about one champion in Congress. We don't have a dedicated champion who's pushing aging issues. And the AAPI issues are somewhat also diverse at this, you know, the spread. So if we look at the larger sociopolitical context, I would argue to you that the ideological divide has gotten worse, and that we know that some candidates are saying, get rid of all entitlement programs. The Older Americans Act and many of the new initiatives that we have come out of discretionary fund parts. That means that Congress can easily get rid of them. The entitlement programs, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, that's what they're saying, get rid of. If you get rid of that, if you get rid of discretionary funded programs, we have nothing left. So I would say that is extraordinarily important. Aging programs are not cheap. They are costly. But they're costly because of the intensity of care, because the numbers are growing, because of that diversity in the older adult population, which is more and more beginning to actually parallel or look like the general population, with a few exceptions. In addition to that, there are competing priorities. And I would say more and more differentiation within these competing priorities as well. And out of all of this, I think one issue that is emerging to be an issue around which the global community will likely be able to coalesce is the issue of inequality. And under that, insecurity. And I don't mean, you know, just insecurity in terms of defense, but I'm talking about insecurity in relation to poverty, insecurity in relation to water, insecurity in relation to food, insecurity in relation to homes, etc. So when we look at the White House Conference on Aging, Kathy Greely, who is currently the Assistant Secretary on Aging, was asked, so what's going to, you know, how will we know this White House Conference has been a success? And she said, we'll have to look at the outcomes. We'll have to look at what actually is produced. And so the other thing that I would say is accountability is going to be really important. So if we indeed go towards a more technologically driven, community-based kind of participatory, you know, opportunity for people to bring in their ideas about aging, then I think we also have to be very, very careful and be sure that we've built in mechanisms for accountability. So going forward, one other thing I will say is this, that if you look at the Asian American population in particular, that I think we also need to think about that population differently. And the reason I say differently is because, as well, there's differentiation within it. But we are going to begin to understand the Asian American population within a larger context. 60% of the world's people are Asian. So whenever I introduce myself to the new class of students at the School of Social Work at Columbia, because we have 800 students in our master's program, I say to them, come learn diversity well. And just remember that you, those of you who have enjoyed being the majority in the U.S. are really the minority in the world. So it's important to know how to deal with diverse people. I'm actually suggesting that as we go forward, and therefore, we have to ask ourselves what form of government or what form of participatory democracy is actually going to work for us. Secondly, advocacy is going to have to be different because of technology. And finally, that we better really think about who we are as a people, and not just people within the United States, but in the larger world community. Because what happens in the world happens in the U.S. What happens in the U.S. increasingly, not necessarily, is accepted in the world. So I think that there's some really serious fundamental rethinking that needs to occur. And probably what I will do is end with this. That George Bush said, I've often thought the process of aging could be slowed down if it had to go through Congress. I agree with that. But there is a Greek saying that I really believe in, and it really goes back to my initial point. But I may not be able to cure, but I sure can care. And I can care by being sure that those of you who are students in this room are well prepared to take care of our society so that my 110-year-old father still be thriving and will still be enjoying a good quality of life. And so the saying that I will close with is a Greek saying that I love. A society grows great when old men and women plant trees whose shade they know they shall never sit in. Let us hope that we can do that. Thank you.
It's always great when we can work in how efficient Washington, D.C. is, so thank you for that, given that's what we talk about quite often at 30 Rock. Thank you, Dr. Takamura. I'd like to move directly now to Dr. Hill. Now, Dr. Hill serves as the director of the NIA Office of Special Populations. He comes to the NIA from the Eunice Kennedy Shriver National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, where he was a contract officer's technical representative with the National Children's Study after serving as health scientist administrator for the Extramural Associates Research Development Award. And I can feel him standing behind me now. Is he standing there? Is he doing it? He's standing. Yeah, he's standing. Okay. So we're going to try to get the slides moving, Dr. Hill. Do you know how to work this?
Yeah, let's see if I can.
Okay. Eureka!
There we go.
Dr. Hill!
All right, thanks for that introduction. I'm really excited to be here and serve on today's panel. What an interesting topic, I think, for health disparities. And Dr. Takamura really put this in context in terms of the federal climate and the products of the White House Conference on Aging. So we're at the National Institute on Aging, which is a part of the Department of Health and Human Services. Farheen Akbar, who's here in the crowd, is my colleague and a collaborator on this a very brief presentation. We wanted to take some time to talk just a bit about framing health disparities research and what we do is funding, providing resources for research that would potentially focus on the health of aging Asian American and Pacific Islander American. So this is the context in which I would talk about this. Really give some background on health disparities research and then maybe mention a couple of next steps and opportunities that may be relevant for the group. And I hope I can do this within 10 minutes, so I'll keep it quick. But just really quickly, I didn't want to assume that that we all knew what the NIH is and is mandated to do. And at its basic level, we're looking to stimulate fundamental knowledge and the application of that knowledge for which I think is protecting public health. So in many ways, we see ourselves as the premier biomedical funding agency in the world. And we feel good about that. We may or may not be that, but we aspire to be. The National Institute on Aging is one of 27 institutes and centers that are part of the Institute, the NIH. Others that may be relevant for today are the Institute on Minority Health and Health Disparities, and just a host of other institutes and centers that are committed to the protection of population health and health disparities research. So NIH specifically was started in 74. This is quick background about who we are, and we're really interested in considering and thinking critically about the special problems of the aging population. I've bolded that in red, and also providing research resources, right? So in a broad range of activities of what can be done, there's applied public health, there's community health. Our job is to provide research resources and disseminate information that comes from those resources about protecting health of special populations. So quickly, our director is still Richard Hodes, who's been there for quite some time, and I work in the division of the Office of Special Populations, which is in the Office of the Director, along with Farheen Akbar, who is also in the Office of the Director as well. But I wanted to give you a sense of our four divisions. We have a division of Aging Biology, a division of Behavioral and Social Research, Neuroscience, and Geriatrics and Clinical Gerontology, which spans a range of areas, all looking to stimulate and support innovative research that is related to special populations and very related to today's panel. So much of my talk will stimulate, will be stimulated by a portfolio analysis that was conducted in 2012 that took a look at our grants portfolio for the previous 10 years, and there were several takeaways that came from that analysis. One, most of our research in health disparities was centered around behavioral and social research, not that much in aging biology. And as far as dollars were concerned, there was quite a bit of our research that was committed to Alzheimer's disease, which may or may not be the case because we're having a difficult time measuring the outcome of AD in population health. So there were some real gaps that we saw in terms of what was important. Several recommendations came from that portfolio analysis. As I mentioned before, stimulating aging biology research, certainly supporting more socioeconomic research in health disparities. But one that was very critical was the adoption of a conceptual integrated framework to address health disparities research. And when we think about health disparities, it's really linked to the concept of minority aging, where we focus on populations. We take our lead from the public law that governs the Institute on Minority Health and Health Disparities, which names in that law Asian Americans and Native Hawaiians and other Pacific Islanders as primary health disparities populations. So it's very important to this group to know that when we think about health disparities research at NIH, Asian Americans and Native Hawaiians and other Pacific Islanders are a primary health disparities population for us to provide research resources to stimulate better understanding. So I see I have 5 minutes, it was going very quickly, but when we think about health disparities research, we're talking about determinants of very related outcomes. If multimorbidity is an outcome over the life course, there are differences in the prevalence of multimorbidity among racial ethnic groups. Our real task is understanding whether these determinants lie at the environmental level of analysis. Are they strictly biological? Are they social and behavioral? And really, how does all of this fit for understanding pathways that lead to the development and sustaining of these health disparities? So there are a few ways to look at this. There's the class way, where we know that there's an advantage of SES for several aging related outcomes, including dementia. Also, there's this the theory that race and class intersect to create a very interesting circumstance for a number of groups. So we've come to define health disparities research as very specific levels of analysis, those that are environmental, sociocultural, behavioral, and biological. We've developed a framework, which we're really hoping to gain some important traction in stimulating research among you all, among those that are interested and passionate in the extramural research community, along these levels of analysis that are part of our definition. But the primary question is, what are the pathways for priority health disparities populations? How does this all fit? How do these levels of analysis lead to just a host of minority aging issues and health disparities issues? So just a sense, a quick flavor of some of the grants that we do support that focus on Asian Americans. There's the study of women's health across the nation. Everyone's probably quite familiar with something like this, but we have a representation of Chinese and Japanese Americans here really looking at the health of women in this country. There's the project from Dr. Dong there in Rush University here in Chicago that looks at the epidemiology of psychological distress in a Chinese aging population, really focusing in on psychological well-being and looking at factors that really link into our understanding of environmental, sociocultural, and behavioral factors. Did a couple of others. We have this particular project here, which I think is really interesting, that focuses in on Japanese American men and energy sensing pathways healthy aging and longevity. So the point here is that we do have investments that are really focusing in on Asian Americans and Pacific Islander Americans, but we need more. So I'll end on a real opportunity that I think is quite relevant. The first is an RFA that's currently active, an R01, which is the flagship funding mechanism at NIH that looks at stress and resilience and health disparities and aging. And given that Asian American and Pacific Islander Americans are priority health disparities populations, then your ideas, your research interest for this particular population would be priority for this funding announcement. So this is a 5-year award at a cap of $500,000 per year. So a real opportunity to stimulate some real research around health disparities in this particular population. We also have an R01 in Alzheimer's disease, and I'm ending here. Same kind of deal where the focus on this population is the priority, but looking at Alzheimer's disease, and then an R03 for smaller projects. So I'll end with what I think, where we are. And one, we've described the problem, so we know about a number of health outcomes as they relate to Asian Americans. And we're really sharpening our focus for engaging communities and really conducting research in the right way through community-based participatory research. There are a number of frameworks that describe how these factors may be important for our health disparities populations. The innovation now, I think, is to do what Dr. Takamura said, and that is to look at the within group differences, whether they are ethnic or socioeconomic, geographical, but really taking a deeper look at how our populations of interest are different and how that leads to health disparities. And that, I think, really looks into what we're trying to stimulate here, and that's locating these pathways and mechanisms, right? So we've got to get out of our disciplinary silos and start putting teams together to understand how these really important levels of analysis link for our priority populations, Asian Americans and Pacific Islander Americans being one of those. So thanks for your time. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Hill. Now that we have reached the halfway point of this session, ensuring a healthy future for Asian American, Pacific Islander American older adults, we're going to show a little bit of a video, and Lan, I'm not sure how we're going to get to that, but I will try. Hit this button here, and then go here. Just a little bit of a background as Lan tries to bring it up. This is a story that I had told a year ago during a series of The Hungry, and it was focused on a community that's not often thought to be hungry. Yet, as I'll show in the story, in my small town of New York City, the largest group of, and here we go.
This is the season of big meals, and for one group, though, it is not. New AARP data this month shows how poverty has particularly affected one group. They are the hidden hungry. Spry 79, Yingrong Ji, has been a U.S. citizen for 6 years, and every year here, he's been on the poverty line.
We don't have enough money to have.
He is a face of the hidden hungry, of what's not a Hmong minority. 1 in 10 Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders are food insecure, according to AAPI data. Greg White runs a D.C. area community services organization and sees this problem every day.
This is more chronic. When I say that, this is food insecurity that isn't resolved. It happens over and over, so we see them on a repeat basis.
It's worse than totally. AARP found Asian American senior citizens are more likely to be on food stamps than the overall senior citizen population at a rate of 14 versus 9%.
The sense of community and community taking care of each other also mask the needs in the community.
Miwua is from Asian Americans Advancing Justice. She believes multiple families often share food to help each other, but that, she says, in turn hides the problem. Another reason this group stays hidden, they don't speak English, which keeps them from accessing help. 3 out of 4 Asian American adults speak English as a second language. One social worker that specializes with this group explains.
They're more private. They don't ask for a lot.
The Center for Economic Security found 29% of Asian Americans live in poverty, the highest of any group in the city.
Even though they just have a little bit, they like to share it with others. I gained 20 ounces when they bring a gift like that to me, I couldn't possibly turn it down. I tell them how wonderful it is. You know, someday someone's going to bring me a live chicken, probably. And they look like it all kinds of gifts.
I think she may have gotten a live chicken. By the way, food banks have started to bring in language services and specific community outreach programs for Asian American and Pacific Islanders, a group where more than 100 different languages are spoken.
So Daphne Kwok, who is our next speaker, asked us to play that, and actually when I was going out to work on this story, it was so important that we had data from AARP, and a lot of the thoughts behind that story on the Hidden Hungry certainly is applicable when we talk about healthcare, and it's just simply understanding the complexity as it was described in the story, as well as just the culture of asking for help when help is needed.